Hello and welcome to Provox, a podcast from the Queen's College, Oxford.
It's a huge pleasure to welcome Satnam Sangira to this latest In Conversation. I'm slightly starstruck, actually, because I've really enjoyed reading Satnam's stuff for a long time. I'm also a little nervous because this is somewhat off my territory compared with some of the other people we've been talking to. So I hope you're going to do most of the speaking.
I'm prepped to answer some questions about economics. And ask me anything you like.
We're definitely going to ask ask the audience to ask some questions. I'm sure you all know, I think Satnam has probably, he's done two things I think extraordinary. One is this amazing memoir, The Boy with the Top Knot, which I mean, I'd read his two Empire books anyway, and I thought, preparing for this, I'd better read this blooming memoir. And actually, I enjoyed it actually even more than the Empire books. I really would recommend reading it, as we were just discussing. I think when you read about other people's life experiences and biographies, you really learn something about yourself. But I also learned an awful lot about, you know, the country that I've lived in for the last nearly 60 years, and a part of it that I wasn't particularly aware of. And, you know, I had no idea that I was also going to be learning about mental health problems within Satnam's family. So that was extraordinary. But of course, the what he's probably best known for is the work that he's done on Empire, Empire World, and Empire Land, as well as books for children, which are even harder to write, which I confess I haven't read, though I might have found easier. So it's incredibly kind of you to come to this event and come and speak to us.
I came mainly because my wife came to Oxford and her father's very proud of it. But then neither of them came along. So
actually, I thought it was because I asked you. But anyway,
and you asked me. Yeah.
Anyway, so it's very, very kind of you to come. We'll talk mostly about history and empire and stuff. But I did want to start on your life, because you've written about it, I assume, very openly. It certainly comes across as very open in the way that you've written about it. It's 20 years, is it, since you published Boy with the Top Knot?
Nearly,
something like that.
Nearly,
so maybe your
life has changed.
Life and memories and so on have changed. But I think in a very dramatic way, you bring to life what I think a lot of us feel, which is that the life that we live as adults is often very different from where we come from as children. But that clearly, you know, you were at the time of writing it feeling very much this tension between your background in a Punjabi family in Wolverhampton, growing up very much among that family and people from that background with set of expectations, and a metropolitan life in London, which was quite extreme by the sound of it, driving Ferraris and interviewing celebrities. So I suppose a couple of questions. How silly question, given that you wrote about how hard it was. Can you just tell us about how hard that leap was from that one life to the other life? And have you come more to terms with it as you've, reached, I guess, 50-ish.
Yeah, nearly 50. The 50 this year. Yeah, I mean, I've got to say, I know there's a lot of authors in the audience. I would not write that book now. It's like, it was an act of incredible naivety. And you're right, I revealed so much. It's insane. It was insane. It could have gone so wrong. And I would say that you will never find anyone more private than someone who's just written a memoir. Because you know what could go wrong, but equally it worked out. Almost nothing went wrong with that book.
Yeah,
and my parents came round to my argument. And the other day, I was thinking, because I suffered a family bereavement last week, and I was writing a funeral speech, and I was thinking about our family, and almost all of my nephews and nieces have married someone outside the Sikh faith.
But all of your cousins didn't.
And they still haven't.
Yeah.
And so our family reflects modern Britain. And yeah, my parents are the most traditional of all the parents of their generation. And I think if I can take some of the credit, it's because one person has to do it. I think it's the same for people who are gay in the closet. It felt like coming out. Or it's in families that have a lot of secrets. It takes one person to tell the truth, and then everyone else can tell the truth. Unfortunately, the person who tells the truth has a heavy cross to bear. And it was a really, really stressful thing to do, but it all worked out. One thing I'm very glad about is that when I wrote the book, my sister asked me to delete a whole chapter because it was too personal for her, about her.
Was that pulley?
Yeah. And at the time, I really resented it because it was a month's work. But I'm so glad she did, because now we have a deeply private experience in our family that no one really knows about. And I'm glad I protected that. Also, I'm really glad that I wrote the book then, because I now can't remember anything about my childhood. And I recommend that is
Oh.
that if you want to write a memoir, any of you, take the notes as soon as you can, because you can't remember it. And also, the other thing is people die. And so you need to be able to interview the people who knew you when you're young if you can't remember yourself. So I'm very glad I wrote it, but I would never do it again. I'm also glad it got made into a TV film and not a feature film. Because if it's a feature film, people keep watching it. But now, as you found, it's quite hard to find
Yeah, I actually I
it.
forked out 8 quid to watch it on YouTube last night.
Yeah. You're probably the only person who's watched it this year. And it's a big deal on that week when it was on the BBC, but then it's over. And thank God. Because you don't really want to go over the worst things that have ever happened to you again and again and again.
Yeah,
But thank you for bringing it up.
no. That was a great book. It really was. I mean, it's interesting. I also watched a little interview with you when you looked a little younger than you do now, which is another problem with being on telly when people can
Yeah.
see you when what you used to look like. It's Anita Rani said that. Well, I've quoted exactly what we know as British Asians is you just don't air your stuff. Nobody talks about it. You keep it there and just carry the burden. And
Yeah, I mean,
you did the opposite.
yeah, and when I was researching the book, I was trying to find Indian family memoirs, and there were none. It's quite a big country, India, but there were no Indian family memoirs.
Wow.
And I think there were a couple like political memoirs and boring biographies, but none. It's a Western form. More than that, it's an American form. And so looking back, actually, it was quite an interesting thing to do. Now there's a lot. There's quite a few. Again, if one person does it, then quite a few other people do it. But, and if there were any, they were novelized like Hanif Qureshi. So yeah, I didn't realize how brave I was being, and stupid.
Well, I think I mean, reading it sounded like you were finding it really difficult to do. So I think
Yeah.
you probably did know you were being pretty brave. But you grew up in a family that you describe it was, I mean, maybe you say you didn't feel it at the time, clearly pretty poor in a very sort of homogeneous society. But the big change I sense in your life was when you went to Wolverhampton Grammar School, which I think is a private school, but you got an assisted place, is that right? Do you see that as the big moment in your life that sort of changed your whole trajectory?
Yeah, I mean, it did. Well, I mean, it's a classic story of social mobility that, places like this benefit from. A lot of grammar school boys end up in Oxbridge and then feel alienated when they arrive in this environment. It's such a common British story. And I talking to Jeff Dyer about it, Jonathan Coe. I mean, it's such a routine thing. And we celebrate it, don't we, when people from a very poor background get a first class degree from Oxbridge and go into establishment professions. And it's great and it's definitely made me, but we don't think about the cost. And I think there's a cost to social mobility, which is that you become alienated from where you're from and your own family. Your accent changes. The things you talk about changes. Your
You don't
references
sound ever
change.
so Wolverhampton, I have to say.
A bit. Slightly, but I used to have a very heavy Indian accent and a very heavy Black Country accent. But yeah, and then the pressure is often on the person who's left to keep those relationships alive. It's the Billy Elliot story. And I think I went through quite a lot of resentment that I was the one who always had to make the effort. to keep those relationships alive. I was the one who was too posh, who read to, and still now people take the mickey out of me reading books. I'm like, yeah, I'm a writer. It's like taking the mickey out of my cousin who's a builder for having tools, you know? But it still happens. And even now, I have to take it on the chin. But there is a cost of that. But I think I'm glad I made the effort to keep those relationships going. Mm. I don't think I lost any relationships.
Mm. I guess in a way, you've got a stronger set of relationships at home than many of us sort of white British would. I mean, I don't have 54 first cousins. I think I've got one. I don't know, because, you know, you've got...
Well, you have your weekends. You have to go to weddings every weekend.
But that, you know, that...
You get on with your one cousin. I hope you do.
I don't really see her. Oh.
That's the whitest thing I've ever heard.
Well, that's what I mean. You know, it's very easy to lose those links. But your background, sort of, your parents were immigrants from the Punjab. You're obviously very connected in a sense with that. And that, as you write, is sort of a consequence of empire. I mean, you know, if it had not been for the British Empire, we wouldn't have such a big Indian community here. I mean, is that what drove you to, is that the reason behind your interest in empire?
Yeah, basically, I got to my early 40s and realized that almost everything about my life could be explained by the British Empire. You know, the fact my parents are here, that I was there, even probably the way in which Sikhs are talked about as this martial race. Mm. It's the way we see ourselves. That's an identity that was supercharged by the British. The language we speak, probably the racism we faced. Enoch Powell, the local MP in Wolverhampton, you know, quite famous for certain things. And his ambition in life was to be Viceroy of India.
Yeah.
The newspaper I ended up on had imperial overtones. The language, the way in which the Times talks about the world, the politics, Brexit, so much. Can explain by, partly at least, by the empire. And I knew nothing because, like many people, I wasn't taught about it. Mm. And so I just started educating myself. And often we write what we want to teach ourselves, right? And so it became a book. And I remember I didn't get a particularly big advance. And I remember doing a reading and some of my friends were there and they were just confused by it. And they were like, why are you talking about empire? You're not a historian. It sounds complicated and it didn't seem particularly relevant. And then suddenly Black Lives Matter happened. And one of the chapters I was writing, that theme was the lead item on the news. Clive Murray went to America and did a whole item, lead item, about how much America's racism could be explained by the British Empire. And that was something I was writing about. And suddenly my niche thoughts were the biggest subject in the world. And the pandemic happened. I wrote a book very quickly, finished it quickly because there was nothing else to do. And it did really well and disproportionately well because I think lots of people felt the same in that they didn't know.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, I think I was vaguely aware in primary school, and this would have been in the 1970s, and we kind of learned that British Empire would be the biggest empire ever, and we all sort of felt a little bit proud of that. But that was it. I don't think I did anything further about the empire in my formal education, and that is part of what you write about, which is that we are unbelievably, almost deliberately ignorant of this.
Yeah, I mean, I was talking to Gideon Rachman, who's a very respected foreign affairs commentator on the FT. He went to Oxford, studied world history, I think. He told me he'd learned nothing about the British Empire.
Blimey,
I don't know how you miss the British Empire in world history. It was the biggest empire in human history. It lasted quite a long time. Explains quite a lot of geopolitical situations, I would say. But he didn't learn anything about it. I find that amazing. You almost have to willfully try to ignore it, something to be like that, right?
Well, you'd think so. But as you say, and particularly... I mean, what you're really looking at in Empire Land to a large extent is the extent to which it has shaped us. It shaped the country. Now, is it very striking? You don't talk much about racism that you experienced in your memoir, but you do talk a little bit more about racism in the Empire books. I mean, to what extent Is it, again, this is counterfactual, it's very hard to know, but the relationship between empire and racial prejudice, I mean, how do you trace that as opposed to non-empire and racial prejudice?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I faced a huge amount of racism, actually, compared to other people I talked to, but it was there in Enoch Powell's Wolverhampton, very definitely.
Yeah.
There were occasional race riots.
I mean, the extraordinary thing you say about Enoch Powell is at some point he denied there ever was an empire.
Yeah. Well, there we go. And that's and the amnesia taken to the extreme. Your question was about, I forgot
about
your question.
About the impact of empire on our, you know, on racism, on our attitudes
to race. Yeah, I mean, there's a very clear link. I mean, there's multiple links. I mean, even now there's certain racial stereotypes that exist in this country, like, and I got this when I was interviewing for jobs 20 years ago. Oh, we'll give you a shot because Indians work hard. And there was an idea. They were the global labor force. And there's another racist stereotype. Oh, black people are lazy and, you know, they won't work unless they're compelled. Slavery. That's where that comes from. Oh, Sikhs, Gurkhas are military people. There's a campaign to start a Sikh regiment at the moment. Daily Telegraph are really into it. That was literally a racial stereotype created during the 19th century. Racial science, which emerged in the 19th century, you know, had a very distinctly British flavour. It played a factor in, you know, inspiring the Nazis, and it turned into something else in America. But the British were involved in that. Institutions at Oxford were involved in creating that weird, screwed up racial science, the idea that people had certain physiques and certain attributes because of their race. These were very powerful ideas and persist, I would argue, even to the present day. And even when the race riots started happening in Britain, you know, in the 20s and then the 50s, that racial violence often followed the same pattern of racial violence in the colonies. You know, I think there's a direct link.
In what sense?
Well, often the race riots that happened in Britain, when you look at them, especially in the 20s and 50s, they often happened because a person of color, a brown man or a black man, was seen with a white woman.
Right, yeah.
It's odd. That was often the thing that lit the tinderbox. And there was that fear was a major fear in the imperial imagination that white women had to be protected from the black and brown menace. And that motivated a lot of kind of racial segregation. But also, you know, the way in which races were targeted during certain massacres, and the way people talked about, say, Sikhs or black people, it's pretty much how they were talked about in Britain in the early and middle 20th century.
And where do you think we are now? I mean, better place than we were in the mid 20th century.
Well, this is the weird thing, you know, in that, was it Napoleon who said we imagine the world as it was when we were 20? And I grew up at a very optimistic time in the 90s. Well, I felt that everything was getting better, that racism was becoming less and less a problem, that it wasn't particularly a problem for me and my friends. But it's back, isn't it? In a very profound way. I don't think that's a controversial statement. And it feels like it had never gone away. We were just deluded, and maybe it was always there and it was just suppressed. And people learned how to talk, but actually, ancient racisms and, I mean, anti-Semitism, I think I've heard my Jewish friends say this, they never thought it would come back. They thought they were okay. And now it's a daily occurrence. And it feels the same with other kinds of racism. It's out there. We see it on social media. We see people using that language. And it's affected my life in a way it never affected my teenage life. Now I can't really be on social media because you say anything and you get racially abused. And any person I know of color has the same experience. And actually any Jewish person has the same experience. They get racially abused just for existing.
And I mean, it's extraordinary how so many of these conversations come back to the impact of new technology, social media, the way that we communicate with one another. And I guess what you're saying is a sense that was always latent and has been allowed to thrive because social media just makes it so easy.
Yeah, but also people frustrated and they want, you know, hate subjects and they want an outlet, someone to blame.
Yeah. Which, you know, we can talk about economics and how, you know, the what, you know, people's general frustrations about economy, but let's not do that. So you went into writing Empire Land, you know, partly because of your experience, but and partly presumably as a way of understanding the country that you grew up in and the country that we are now. But from a position, again, you write this very sort of in a very sort of honest and quite humble way. But you claim from a position of considerable ignorance. I mean, how on earth do you go about starting? We were talking earlier. I mean, I've written a book, and I basically wrote it only after I basically knew what I wanted to write. So I didn't actually have to do much research. But my sense is you must have put, you know, enormous amounts of research into this from scratch.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what I kind of like to do. I love that feeling at the start of a project that you can't do it, because I didn't feel like I had a memoir in me. You know, I didn't think memoirs were written by people like David Beckham and or ghostwriters of David Beckham and retired diplomats. I didn't think I had a memoir in me, but I kind of read a lot of them and taught myself and learned how to do it. Mm. And then by the end, you're like, wow, I did it. I don't know if it's any good, but I did it. Yeah. Felt the same with the novel. And I guess I did the same with a history book. I felt really intimidated by the history because there's every book on the British Empire is minimum 900 pages long.
Yeah.
Minimum.
Well, it's a big empire.
It's a big empire. And oh my God, they all disagree with each other.
Yeah.
And
it's
the most poisonous subject.
Yeah. Why? I mean, it clearly is. I mean, what's your sense of why it's so poisonous?
It's because it's personal. I think lots of different, but mainly it's personal. Most of us have a direct connection to the history. Our family were on the side of the colonizers or the colonized. And I think the reason people have a visceral reaction to people like me and David Oyusoga often is before we've even opened our mouths, is they think, are you basically saying my grandfather was a racist?
Yeah.
Are you brown person telling me my grandfather racist? I knew him, he wasn't. And that is why David Oyusoga has a bodyguard at public events, why I don't do public events unless they're very posh like this. You know? It's because it gets viscerally personal. I mean, people come to my events and just shout at me. You know, and then they leave and they get it out of their system.
Yeah.
And they generally think I'm evil.
And you think it's because they think that you're attacking their family, as it were. I mean, that person.
It's always about identity. Like they really, it means so much to them. You know, being British means having run the biggest empire in history. They're proud of that. Why is this person criticizing it or saying it wasn't great? And they also, they've been told a story. It's not only they believe that. They went to school and they were told they were great, you know, and now, because that's what happens with history gets revised, you know. I mean, Rishi Sunak said recently, when he was prime minister anyway, you know, he was asked about slavery and he said something along the lines of, I wish historians would stop unpicking history. And it's like, dude, that is literally what historians do. That's their job description.
A couple of tutorial posts we can get rid of.
There's a narrative.
Just stop.
It gets unpicked. It happens with everything. It happens with our understanding of Pompeii. Yeah. It happens with our understanding of Henry VIII.
Yeah.
It's definitely happening with Empire. We're getting alternative views, the viewpoints of the colonized, of women, of, you know, of loads of... And of course it's going to change, but people don't react well to change.
Yeah, and I mean, and I guess something that I mean, for some people, this is still, you know, very recent. I mean, I don't know when we think of empire as ending. And again, you say in your book, you know, people disagree about when empire ended or indeed whether it existed. But certainly, it's within the lifetime.
I think we can say existed.
I think we can. whatever Enoch Powell might say.
Enoch Powell might disagree.
But certainly within the living memory of plenty of people alive, there was a significant British Empire, and therefore we're bound to be looking at it again and relearning and understanding it from a new generation's point of view.
Yeah, I think a lot of, not everything. I don't know, people often accuse me of saying everything explained by the British Empire. It's not. But I do think a certain amount of our political frustration today with Keir Starmer, with the fact that we've had how many, 10 prime ministers in for 6 years? I don't know, any 15, whatever.
Anyway, yeah.
Part of the frustration in Britain is that we ruled a quarter of the world.
Yeah.
And now we don't.
Yeah.
And now we can't even build HS2. You know? Now we can't even fix the potholes. What happened to us? And there's this deep psychic frustration, which means that no one can do the job. You know? How do you resolve that? There's been no reckoning. And so it comes out in dysfunctional ways.
Yeah, so there's a lot of reckoning to do. And again, I mean, Empire World especially is full of pretty traumatic stuff. I mean, the appalling things that, you know, individual British people and, you know, institutionally did to slaves, did to people in India, what have you. My sense is we really haven't reckoned with that.
No, and I found a really interesting thing related to that. You know, the angriest book I've ever read about the legacies of the British Empire, about how it fucked up the world, is by Kwasi Kwarteng.
Yes, you quote him, yes.
Ghosts of Empire. I don't know if anyone's read it in the room. It's actually a really amazing book, but much, much angrier than I've ever been. And yet he's on the right of the Conservative Party.
Well, maybe his budget was revenge.
But it shows you how contrived the culture war is.
Yeah.
You know, it's just nonsense. Actually, I'm doing an event with him tomorrow. And he's the only historian I've ever met who doesn't want to talk about his book. But I want to get him to talk about it. I want him to explain.
So interesting.
You know, why this whole... And the odd thing is when Empire Land came out, you know, it got well-reviewed everywhere, including The Telegraph. Is it Tim Stanley? Well, I don't know if this has been recorded. Tim, he gave me a good review, you know, and he's a massive Brexiteer. And he said something along the lines of, you know, we might disagree politically, but the facts are on Satnam's side. The empire could be rotten. But now, The Telegraph, if they ever refer to me, use me as an example of wokery gone insane, you know? And something has happened in the 5 years since that book came out.
Wow.
Something's happened to The Telegraph.
Oh, something's definitely happened to The Telegraph.
But something's happened to Britain and the culture wars. Everyone's got radicalized. And I felt like, I mean, I was attacked by the left for being too gentle on the empire.
Mm.
And I got it because I'm pretty much a centrist, right?
Yeah. And you are careful to, you know, not come to strong judgments.
Yeah. But now I am used as, I'm a poster boy of woke insanity, which is quite bizarre for me because I'm really not. I work for the Times, for God's sake. You know? We work on the same page.
Indeed, absolutely.
It's like, yeah, so it's odd what people think of you.
Yeah, that's almost, your sense is that the centre of gravity on this has almost moved back towards Empire Was a Wonderful Thing, having started to move away?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's been a deliberate, well-funded campaign to change the conversation. And
Well-funded by...
All these Tufton Street think tanks, right. Restore History, the same organisations attacking the National Trust. Hmm. You know, it's come in the last 5 years. And why is that? I think you can find a clue in the fact if you look at opinion surveys. If you look at public opinion surveys, the British public are actually incredibly nuanced about the empire. I think something like 75% of British people think it's a good idea to teach empire and slavery in schools.
Mm-hmm.
You never would guess that from reading The Telegraph or The Mail. The majority of people think empire could be good and bad. The British public are really quite sophisticated on this subject. But because they are sophisticated, that's why there is a well-funded campaign to change the narrative.
And some recent books, which are, you know, I think not historically terribly accurate, really painting the empire in very rosy terms.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, Nigel Bigger's book.
I was thinking,
why didn't you invite him?
I wasn't going to use his name, but yes, that's exactly what I was thinking.
I've not read the book, but I'm told that he refers to me more than a dozen times. And Yeah, the thing is, and Restore, what's that organization? Restore Britain or Restore History, whatever it's called. That right wing think tank.
Wait, that's the same
name. History that, Reclaimed.
Okay.
History
Restore
Reclaimed.
Was the name of that party that's to the right of Reform, isn't it?
Yeah.
The one that won Great Yarmouth.
But those historians in that group, almost none of them are expert imperial historians.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm not either. But everyone I refer to is an expert imperial historian, even people I don't agree with. I don't cherry pick my evidence. I quote people who disagree with my politics, and those kind of books don't. But that is where we are in the world of social media and really partisan politics. You find someone who just makes your case and you just bang on about it, and that's all that matters. Mm. You're in your echo chamber and everyone else is evil and stupid.
I mean, coming back to this, I mean, this evidence of, you know, I mean, evidently, the dreadful behaviour of individual, I mean, dreadful as in, you know, mass murder and slavery, and I mean, you draw out lots of examples in your books. I mean, what does that? I know this is a kind of cliched question in history. What did you take from that in terms of teaching us about what causes that kind of awful behavior? I mean, in a way, we've spent lots of time, I'm not comparing this with the Holocaust, but we've spent lots of time thinking about what drove that, but it doesn't feel to me like we've spent lots of time thinking about what drove British people 100 years ago or less to be, you know, going out murdering people.
I think there's multiple factors, but I think one major factor behind it, and also one, it's the same factor that explains our amnesia, is that the empire was abroad. So it was out of mind. So, you know, Britain benefited from sugar, the money, the prestige, some of the ideology from having an empire, but it was never
here.
Here.
Yeah.
So when it was over, you could act like it never happened. So, and we're a tiny island, and you could act like it wasn't a thing. And literally to such a degree that Enoch Powell said it never happened, you know? And I think that is a big factor in the deep dehumanization.
Yeah.
But one important thing I always try to say when people mention these things is that almost nothing bad that happened in empire, almost everything bad that happened was observed and opposed in Britain. Mm. I think there's an idea that opposition to empire is something that's just come with David Olusoga and me. Actually, everything in empire was opposed at the time by Virginia Woolf's grandfather, that amazing man. I don't know if you read about him in my book, or Gladstone, or even Winston Churchill describing the Jallianwala massacre as monstrous. Mm. Or even Queen Victoria, who, you know, regularly stood up for her subjects in empire, or, you know, had a go at her generals for taking things too far, you know. And opposition to empire is just as great a British tradition as imperialism itself.
To some extent, sometimes we take that to extremes, it seems to me, in the sense that to the extent we learn about slavery, you'd think that the only thing that ever happened in Britain was the abolition of the slave trade rather than the slave trade itself.
Yeah, there's that famous quote from the Western Trinidadian historian who said, you'd think from the way the British talk about slavery that they only did it so that they could abolish it, yes. You know? But, and we're only just discovering how deep it went. I mean, it's only in the last 2 years that research has probably come out about how the royal family were involved in a slave. The Royal African Company was, you know, probably sent more Africans across the Atlantic than any other organization in the history of the British slave trade. You know, monarchs themselves were making a huge amount of money from this evil trade, you know, and some of the enslaved people who arrived in places like Barbados, they would have the Duke of York's initials branded into their flesh. And that is a narrative that's only beginning to emerge now. Mm. And still our royal family doesn't talk about it, which I find remarkable.
Yeah, and they could make a difference by starting. I mean, if they were, whatever you think of the royal family, they've got a platform in a way that no one else has, and a moral authority actually, and which would give them real something to say about that.
And also, it's their job, surely. Effective.
You think so, particularly international relations, supposedly right? Head of the Commonwealth and so on.
And the whole Commonwealth wants to talk about this.
Yeah.
And regularly, nations protest and write letters during the coronation. Loads of Commonwealth nations did.
Yeah.
And yet, it's the one thing the royal family don't want to talk about. It's a bit
Do you think it's because they're scared that this might lead to demands for reparations, or they're just scared that it's as you were saying, it's kind of, you know, that means I'm calling my great grandfather a racist or what have you?
I think, judging from my minimal interactions with that part of the establishment, I mean, almost everyone in the royal family household seems to be an ex-member of the military. It's a very conservative organization, much more conservative than actually, I think King Charles himself is actually very well read and knows quite a lot about this and spends a lot of time talking to Commonwealth heads of nations. And I think probably wants to do more than he's allowed to do.
Okay, that's interesting.
Yeah. I mean, he's pretty woke, isn't he? That's a vibe I get, you know. But
okay, I don't know him.
But, you know, Viscount General, whoever was running his household, is not, you know. And so, yeah, you've got that tension there. But I remember Prince William saying about 10 years ago, he wanted to get rid of all the ivory in the royal households. Mm. Pretty good thing to do, given they all campaign on the environment and animal welfare and all of that, and ivory. Mm. There's so much ivory in all the palaces, and it never happened. Mm. That's how conservative it is.
Yeah, and it was only his grandfather who went out, you know, shooting tigers and goodness knows what else.
Yeah, Prince Philip shot a tiger, and it was recorded by the BBC TV in the 1960s in India.
Yeah.
It's amazing, isn't it?
It's and yeah, so
didn't he become president of the World Wildlife Fund?
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, you've got to preserve them to be able to shoot them, haven't you?
I mean, that's the contradiction of it. And like all the stately homes and all the palaces are full of mahogany furniture, you know, and forests became almost extinct in parts of the Caribbean because of this mahogany furniture for which there was a huge fashion.
Yeah, which is now very unfashionable.
And then you've got Prince William's Earthshot Prize and they're all campaigning on the environment. It's like you could do a lot by just talking about what your family did. Mm. Just talk about it. I'm not asking you to burn the furniture or anything or even give any money. Just talk about it because that would spark a really interesting conversation.
Yeah. That's as I say, it's interesting the role of the monarchy in many things, but that would be very helpful. How should we think about? I mean, you write in your books about the extent to which some of the big stately homes in England were funded from empire, were funded from the slave trade. How should we think about that now, in the sense of, do we just live with that? Do we try and take it back from them?
Are you veering towards reparations, right? I guess. And the thing is, some of the people involved, some of the families involved, are offering reparations. You know, Laura Trevelyan, Alex Renton, Harewood House. Mm. I mean, they're all literally offering money in part of the reparations program. But I feel like we're nowhere near there as a country. We haven't even begun to talk about it. We haven't even acknowledged what happened. We haven't acknowledged that there was slavery, that we sent 3 million people across the Atlantic, and then we compensated the slave owners with 40% of the national budget. So we have paid reparations. We paid it to the slave owners.
To the bad guys, yeah.
So I feel, and now the conversation about slavery, as it plays out in newspapers and social media, it's very defensive. Yeah. So, slavery's always existed. But it wasn't that bad.
Yeah.
Well, I literally heard it said that, you know, we were kind to our enslaved people. You know, you literally hear that in some American plantation houses, and you hear it in stately homes over here.
But it's a genuine question. I actually don't know how to think about it, even as a sort of as a moral and ethical historical question. How do you know those today who are benefiting 3 generations, 4 generations on? We're all sort of, you know, we're lucky with our inheritance. We're unlucky with our inheritance in its size, in where it comes from. It's a sort of it's an ethical question which people can take very firm views on in one direction or another. But it's one where, as I say, even grabbing hold of the question, how many generations back should you go before you start worrying about this? Is it something specific about money from slavery as opposed to any other stealing of something?
I do wrestle with some of that. It's not clear. It's not a simple conversation. But some of the links are very direct, even today. Like, until recently, one of the richest men in Parliament, apart from Rishi Sunak, was Richard Drax.
Yes.
Whose family made an absolute fortune in Barbados.
Yeah.
From enslavement.
Yeah.
Sugar plantations. They still have a Drax house. I went to see it in Barbados, you know, and there's a pretty direct link there between his massive wealth and slavery.
Mm.
I think he should probably pay some reparations. And Barbados are asking him to.
Mm.
They're asking him to give some of the land back. Pretty clear there. Another clear link is, you know, some of the highest rates of diabetes in the world are in the Caribbean. What did we do there? We sent people from Africa to farm sugar. And then we didn't give them any money to set up a health system. There's something, there's a direct link, you know. And another very direct link is that we didn't give these societies, when we had abolition, we didn't give them money to set up education systems, health systems. And now we go to that same part of the world and poach their health workers. So it's not even like we've got to pay reparations. It'd help if we didn't do active harm. We're like making things even worse.
Yeah.
So I would say, first of all, get educated, work out what happened. Secondly, do no active harm. And then we can begin talking about the bigger subjects, because we're nowhere near it.
Well, it's always a good, educate yourself and do no more harm is always a good starting point for these things. Though even that's not straightforward, in the sense that you don't want to stop people coming over here for a better life if that's what they individually want to do. And of course, it's not even just from our empire. I mean, the Philippines is providing an enormous number of health workers now that no one from the rest of Europe is coming.
And of course, the first man who actively recruited health workers from the Caribbean was
Enoch Powell,
that straightforward guy.
It's funny how he comes up in so many things, isn't it?
Well, just for me, because he was
your local MP.
He was like the wicked witch of the East.
Yeah.
In Wolverhampton.
Yeah. I guess younger students here may not be quite so familiar with him, but he was.
He came up earlier because I met some Sanskrit students, and unless I'm mistaken, I think he studied Urdu and Sanskrit. Yeah, I might need to check on Wikipedia.
Yeah. But I checked on Wikipedia and about you, actually, and what I didn't know was that you were the news bunny.
Oh. See, this is why that entry is not written by me. I wouldn't allow that.
So there's this dreadful program called Live TV about 25 years ago, and that they had to make the news more entertaining. The newsreader dressed up as a bunny. Him.
Yeah, well, I hate to break your fantasy, is that there were probably 600 bunnies, and I did it for 2 days.
Anyway, but you know, you're never going to live that down.
Yeah. It's the only way I could break into the media.
Well, but it's actually a lesson. You know, if you want to get into something, you get in wherever you can.
Yeah, it is.
You know, there are lots of famous people, and the first jobs they did, they don't look anywhere near so glamorous as they do now.
Yeah, I don't think the editor of the Telegraph, his children will probably be doing the same.
No, well, it depends on your background.
Yeah,
how you're going to get in. Usually at the end of the talks I give, I get accused of being a bit miserable. And so the last question I always get asked, and I'm going to ask this.
Can you say something positive?
Can you say something positive? And I hate that question because I always struggle. So come on, you've got to do better than I did.
There is something positive in that the public, there's two different things going on. There's politics, three different things. Politics, there's the social media and media, and then there's the British people. If you look at the opinion polls of what British people think, it's pretty healthy. It's getting increasingly tolerant, increasingly liberal, and increasingly at terms with the history.
So how does that relate to what you were just saying?
There's a campaign to change that narrative, isn't there? There's billionaires who don't like it. There's, interest groups who don't want that, are not happy with it. And that's what you're seeing. And you see it with Elon Musk, it's pretty obvious. He's not even a citizen, and he's very interested in, you know, triggering a far-right narrative in this country. And so the positive thing is that when you meet young people, when you talk to actual British people, they don't have these intolerant views. That's positive, isn't it?
That is positive. I think, look, Satnam Sangera, that was just brilliant.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Thank you so much. We are privileged to have you come here.